a long and expensive campaign draws to a close. And I suppose each of us, according to his own standards, will judge Tuesday night whether it's been all worth it. But when you make that judgment, remember that we could have built 100 public schools, 20 major hospitals, or 3 great universities for the cost of these elections. As it draws to a close, I came across a very personal, rather simple, quite sweet poem by a woman by the name of Judith Viorst called The Election, which I'd like to share with you. Last Wednesday night, after the coffee and Danish, the Cousins Club came out for Hubert Humphrey on the grounds that he is actually a very nice person with a kind heart and is better for the Jews. I said that's good to know. Thursday morning, the man from diaper service arrived with 80 diapers and a Wallace button, explaining that he and George were opposed to treason, rape, and murder, and hoped I was also. I said I'd think about it. On Friday, the babysitter who calls Negroes black people and says things like up against the wall warned us to get out of the establishment bag and vote for Eldridge Cleaver, who knows where it's at, tells it like it is, gets right down to the nitty-gritty, and blood is going to flow in the streets. I said we'd skip the movie. Saturday afternoon at Bloomingdale's, while I was deciding between the purple satin harem pants and a machine washable house coat, the sales girl decided Nixon was the one because she liked the parts about the boy with a dream and the trains whistling in the night and winning it for Ike. I said I'd take the house coat. Sunday, my son informed me that the entire second grade had selected Pigasus the pig, having learned from the science teacher that pigs are not as stupid as they look. I said, science is wonderful. Monday after dinner, our friends from the village, the ones with so much integrity they won't eat grapes, dropped by with Alice's restaurant and I.F. Stone's Weekly to tell us, don't vote. I said I respected their position. They said they respected mine. I wish I had one. I think as the election has progressed, we've all found our positions. We know that we're going to vote. We know that we're voting not only for a personality, but a party. It's become increasingly clear that both of the candidates have personalities despite the overlay of Madison Avenue. It's been clear that both of the parties have traditional fiscal and welfare and international positions. And we, each of us, have judgments that we make about our reaction to these positions. It's clear to us, I think increasingly clear, that there are going to be changes. And despite the rhetoric that it's all very much of the same, it is not. And not only are the two candidates different from each other, not only are the parties distinguishable, but that in January there will be a new administration with new faces and new outlooks and new hopes and plans. But what now? What lies ahead? What do we see in the future? Now, to use the traditional symbols of our people, I am not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, lo navi anochi, lo ben navi. I'm not Gene Dixon, thank God. I think it would be a terrible thing to spend one's life looking into a crystal ball and seeing there not only the reflection of one's own greed for status or power, or wealth. I don't hear little voices from another world. But I am a rabbi. I preach tradition. My tradition tells me that the future is an open book. It's a series of blank pages. It hasn't yet been written. And the question whether January represents the dawn of a new day or the lengthening shadows of a deeper darkness is not yet decided. It will depend upon the wisdom and the will of the new administration and of the American people. And so I've come this morning to think about the future with you, not so much to prophesy, which is a fool's undertaking, but to plead. To plead for a certain quality of mind, a more sober judgment, a more somber vision. This quality of mind which I think the American people and our leaders desperately need at this strange, confused turn in our history. Let me illustrate what I want to say by beginning with a story. The story is about Chelm. Now, in the 18th and 19th centuries, Warsaw was the center, as you know, of the intellectual Yiddish-Jewish world of Eastern Europe. There was a great theater in Chelm, in Warsaw. And those pieces of theater, those elements of the Yiddish stage, which were great successes, were sent out as theater as today to the hinterland. Except they didn't go to Boston, Philadelphia, and Detroit, and Cleveland. They went to Lodz and Vilna and Krakow and to Chelm. And the audiences in Chelm were known for laughing in the wrong places. And because they always applauded just before the heroine began her grand soliloquy. And actors who are never known as silent people began to satirize the audiences of Chelm, very much the way American comedians satirize Podunk or Keokuk or any of the so-called boob cities in America. And Chelm became that place in Jewish folklore which was the seat of folly. And the story was told that when the stork was bringing children to the world, the Jewish stork always carried two bags of young souls in her beak. One was the wise, the Talmidei Hachamim. One was the fools. And just as a stork was flying over Chelm, there was a rip in the bag. And genetically, ever since, Chelm was the center of folly, of innocence, of simple-mindedness among our people. Now, to understand this story about Chelm, you must understand its geography. I've never been there, but I'm told that Chelm sits in the valley, that you approach it over a rather tall mountain, and there's only one road over that mountain, a rather narrow road, which winds round and round up, and then wound and round down. And the road apparently was a rather dangerous place. One particular year, when the drayman was bringing across the road the various yard goods which the women of Chelm had ordered from Warsaw to make themselves new dresses for the holidays, the wind began to blow, and the mule stumbled, and the mule and the rider and the dresses and the clothes all fell down the cliff. And a few days later, the milkman, bringing in the big canisters of milk for the babies of Chelm, carrying them on a yoke as they did in those days, was struggling up this defile, and he slipped, and he too, milk, canisters, and milkman, fell down the long cliff. A few days later, the postman bearing the mail to Chelm from the railroad lines was climbing up the long way, and he too apparently slipped and fell and went rolling down the mountainside. Well, this was a crisis in the life of Chelm. And so the people of Chelm met and wisdom assembled, and they debated for 6 days and they debated for 6 nights what to do about this narrow road and about the dangerous path. And finally, just before the Shabbos, just before they had to interrupt these negotiations, they came to a decision. And what was the decision which they made in their wisdom? They decided to build a hospital at the base of the cliff. Now, I've had the feeling, as I've listened to much of the oratory of this campaign, and to much of that violent enthusiasm which this kind of oratory somehow manages to elicit, that I was listening to these debates in ancient Chelm. For we too have very serious problems. There's a problem of crime and there's a problem of delinquency. And what do? Do we broaden the road? Do we build safety guards against the danger of falling? No, we talk about increasing the police force and making the courts instruments of civic vengeance. And we have a problem of radical dissent, of those who will simply not be part of the social system. And so what do? Do we deal with the issues which they raise? Do we concern ourselves with the climate of life in the ghetto? No, we talk about mace and police dogs and repression. We're always somehow building hospitals at the bottom of the cliff rather than repairing the road, repairing the social order, coming to grips with the very real problems, the very basic problems, the problems which have very expensive solutions, which must be solved, must be dealt with if America is to move ahead. I ask myself why. What is there that is similar in Chelm and in America 1964? Are we so foolish? Are we really so few resources of wisdom? Some of us are fools. Some of us are stupid. And some of the chants which have been taken up during this election are those which can only have been sired by men who think with their passions, who think one moment or two out of a year and are tired out by that exertion. If we really are concerned with the problems of poverty, the problems of disillusioned youth, the problems of alienated poor and of an alienated black group, who in his right mind can conceive that a first aid station, police with batons, police with electric prods, any number of police, can in any way solve the problem which is before us? And I think that the slippage of votes in Mr. Wallace's camp represents that at least some on this fringe of folly have begun to recognize that there must be some other kind of solution to this problem. But what disturbs me most is not that there are Chelmites, Chelmniks, in the south of the United States as well as in the east of Poland. What disturbs me most is that the great bulk of well-intentioned, moderate, middle America seems not to be prepared to look the problems square in the face. We want instant solutions, cheap solutions, and there are no instant solutions, and there are no solutions which do not have a high price tag to them. Let me illustrate what I mean. In this state, we have a governor who has made himself something of a prophet. He's gone about the country these last several years saying that the whole welfare apparatus is really an unnecessary one. It's a costly failure. What's his solution? We'll build a few vocational education schools, a few new schoolrooms, and we'll find jobs in the private sector for all of the men who are now not working. And he evokes images among those of us who work very long hours and very hard, the kinds of images we like, which makes us think that the people who aren't working, who are on public assistance, are really shiftless ne'er-do-wells who ought to be prodded. Why should we, with our hard-earned money, supply them with the necessities of life? And it seems to be a reasonable solution. Give the children the right kind of education, provide enough jobs, we'll dismantle the welfare apparatus, our taxes will go down, and Mr. Rhodes will be elected term after term to whatever office he seeks. Now, the only problem with this solution is that there's no solution at all. In the first place, what school has ever guaranteed that its graduates know anything? What school has ever guaranteed that it teaches something in the classroom? We always think of the dropout as someplace in the city. What family does not have a dropout? Somebody who comes from a good home, from a school system which had every dollar it required for the education of the young, where the class sizes were small, who simply would not buckle down to work, did not get through. We carried him through for a year or two or three until we told him, go join the army or spend a few years until you find yourself. And yes, it is true that there are families which have been on welfare for three or four or five generations. But it's equally true that the vast majority, 99 out of every 100 families who are on welfare, are there for less than 6 months and are never there again. And it's equally true that 80% of those receiving public assistance in the United States today are not able-bodied men who might go to work. The aged, women with young children, the halt, the blind, the mentally ill, the institutionalized, and no amount of jobs, no amount of hiring by General Motors or Ford is going to be able to put these people to work and take them off the public assistance rolls. What am I saying? I'm saying this. I've heard a lot of loose talk during this campaign about the failure of the social welfare system in the United States. I've heard it said that it was inadequately financed, which is true. But I've also heard it says that it is a sterile, bankrupt system which cannot work. And of that, I'm not convinced. I don't know of any other way in which a nation which prides itself on being just and caring for the unfortunate can, in fact, provide them with the necessities of life. Or we can change the basis of the system. We can provide, instead of a monthly dole through the county welfare, we can provide a negative income tax or guaranteed annual wage. But there is no way on God's earth that if we want to provide decency for all, we will not have to maintain a welfare apparatus and, in fact, finance it to a degree far beyond that which we finance it today. The simple fact is, and if the American people are sincere and not hypocritical, if indeed we are committed to social welfare, to the care for the halt and the lame and the blind, the widow and the orphan and the poor, if we are concerned and committed to the improvement of life in the slum and in the ghetto, towards equal opportunity for all, then we're going to have to spend not the approximately $10 billion a year we spend federally now on these programs, but $80 and $100 billion a year or more. The President's Commission on Civil Disorder, the so-called Kerner Commission, made, as you recall, a number of important recommendations towards the reconditioning of housing in the slum, the increase of recreational areas, the improvement of the school system, and the like. What they failed to do was to put dollar signs after each of these programs. So some social workers have done so. The dollar sums are staggering. They're over an annual commitment of $100 billion a year. Now, where will this money be found? I don't know. It'll be found in our paychecks, obviously. Will we pay it? I don't know. We somehow can always find the money to pay for war, an unwanted war, a miserable war, 3,000 miles from our homeland. When it comes to paying for human rehabilitation rather than human destruction, we become miserly and penurious. We fight every increase in tax millage. And one other statement ought to be made. Americans are traditionally trained toward the solving of problems. Something like the space race is right up our alley. We are a nation which was born in the industrial age. Our greatness lies in our ability to see a problem, to evolve a mass attack on it, to throw in enough engineers, enough scientists, enough money to find research and a solution, and then to implement that solution. And if it's a matter of design and construction and engineers and astronauts, we can put a man on the moon. But the human race does not operate the way the space race does. And this is why I speak of a more somber vision. There are no guarantees that if we spend something on the order of $100 billion a year for social welfare programming, for better schools and better medicine and better recreation and better services in the city and for human rehabilitation, there is no proof whatsoever that we will in fact solve the problems of our cities. Conditions will improve, but solutions, there are no solutions in life. Every one of our families has some place in the family tree, a cousin, an uncle, who hasn't worked for 30 years. Now, we provided his welfare. He wasn't on public assistance, but he had a good education. He came from a fine Jewish home. He had all the industrious motivation we all had. But there was something in his psychology, in his genes, he just wasn't about to work. And there are some people that you're not going to be able to force to work. However much you retrain them, and however much you rehabilitate them, and how many job opportunities you offer them, and how much you complain, and how much you threaten to cut them off the welfare roll, they're simply not going to stay with a job. They're not that kind of human being. And it's about time that we accepted this simple proposition. Not every child will receive the same education and benefit by it. Not every adult can be made part of our current capitalist welfare, capitalist workforce. It simply won't be. We're not things on a production line. We are human beings, for better or for worse, idiosyncratic, individual, different, each of us from the other. Now, this is not to say that this social legislation will not make an impact. It will make a tremendous impact. In the last 60 years, the social legislation in the United States has helped to reduce those who live below poverty from 90% of the population to 15% of the population. Think what we could do simply in terms of changing the environment in which children are being raised if we had enough money to rehabilitate Huff and Glenville and the other slums of this city. If we had enough money to cut down the class sizes in the Cleveland public schools from 39 to 21 or 19. If we had enough money to provide adequate courts and adequate lawyers and true due process. If we had enough money to bring counselors and all kinds of social work people into the field. But there are no guarantees. And whatever we do along the way, there will be those who point to our failures, and there will be failures, and who say, aha! The system doesn't work. Here's proof. And there is proof. The system won't work for many. And the system will be terribly costly. It costs more to train one person, to retrain one 18 or 19-year-old in a job opportunity center than it does to send another 19-year-old to Harvard. But shall we not spend that money? How much will it cost us to keep this young person in jails and to chase him down for his various crimes? Shall the money not be spent? It must be spent. But let us not delude ourselves that we will solve the problems of our cities. We will improve the city. We will improve the amenities of American life. But there will be violence, and there will be crime, and there will be poverty. And there will be disease, human disease, mental disease. There will be many of the indices of social failure. We must push ahead regardless. We must move beyond that shallow optimism which makes us engage in a war on poverty. Beyond that frustration when our good intentions somehow do not produce instantaneous results, to a sober vision which makes us hold on to the dream we all share of God's kingdom upon this earth, but at the same time makes us recognize in the words of our ancient mystical tradition that there is no end without a beginning. Human problems simply cannot be solved the same way mathematical, scientific problems can. That whatever we do, we can't make all human beings into saints. We can't make all children over in our own image. We can't guarantee success when we deal with men. There's no institution in this city in which we take greater pride than Belfair. Belfair, over the last 100 years, has done remarkable service. We're proud of it. We wouldn't have it any other way. Belfair, with the most sophisticated psychiatric and medical and counseling skills available in this country, cannot guarantee 100% success with each of the young people who goes there. If Belfair has one success in two in rehabilitating the child to the social environment, it considers itself fortunate. Because Belfair and we, if we are wise, are committed to the ancient rabbinic proposition that he who saves a single life, it is accounted to him as if he saves the world. So as I look ahead towards the next few years, I plead with myself, with my people, with my country, that we will find and maintain the grand vision, but that we will find and maintain also a sober realism which will permit us to see that whatever the war against violence, poverty, race, that we manage to bring together, we will not guarantee stupendous results. We can improve the nation, but we cannot bring it to that period of permanent abundance, permanent security. And yet, to move it in the right direction, surely that is enough. And what is true on the domestic scene is equally true on the international scene. Halloween night, the President of the United States spoke to us. He told us of his decision to stop the bombing of North Vietnam. He told us of the possibility of the National Liberation Front and of the South Vietnamese government joining with Hanoi and with Washington at the Paris peace conferences. To his credit, he did not promise us instantaneous results. His mind, as you recall, seemed to dwell on Panmunjom, on the 3 years of bitter, acrimonious, often vitriolic debate while a war raged around, which preceded the Korean armistice. And my mind jumped on and thought also of the infiltration of South Korea by North Korea in the years subsequent to that armistice, and of our own overflights and of our own ships entering into North Korean waters. There is no end without a beginning. There is no peace which is secure for all times. There is no peace which is fully stable. All that we can ever hope for, really, in a world such as ours, is that little by little we manage to lower the level of violence, that little by little we manage to build into each nation sufficiency, opportunity, prosperity, so that there is no longer the desire to take what another has, and there is always the fear that in battle that country will lose something which is most precious to us. A new administration will take office in a turbulent era. The new administration can be certain to face crisis after crisis after crisis. The crisis of class war is still with us in many parts of the world. The crisis of racial war threatens us in many parts of the world. The crisis of domestic wars threatens many countries of the world. Governments which are authoritarian are being subjected to revolution from below. Governments which are moderate are being radicalized from all sides. Ancient tensions in the Middle East, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America are being exacerbated. We cannot look forward towards a time of growing peace, of growing security. What can we look forward to? What should we expect of the new administration? Largely this: a willingness to deal with the complicated political international problems of our world in such a way that we are moving towards some degree of stability, that we are moving away from brinkmanship and from confrontation and from purely military solutions towards peaceful solutions, towards negotiation, towards diplomacy. Better guerrilla warfare than open warfare. Better political attack than military attack. Better fruitless negotiations than no negotiations at all. This is the kind of world we live in. Would that it were otherwise, but that it is not. And if we are looking for a Messiah, if we are looking for someone who will wave a magic wand and suddenly the sunshine of peace will shower and cascade down upon our world, there is no such Messiah. There are no wars which can be won any longer. There are no peace treaties which are that secure any longer. And there will always be among us, I'm afraid, those who will always fault the wars which cannot be won and fault the pieces which cannot be held stable, who will hold that Versailles or Yalta or Potsdam or Geneva are evil words in the American vocabulary, proofs of the perfidy of the State Department or these diplomats or that around the world. And that is not true. They are simply statements of the kind of world, the volatile, angry, bitter world in which we live. What can we expect of the new administration? They'd think first of sending in the Peace Corps before it sends in the Marine Corps. They'd not accept the proposition that foreign aid is evil, or that it is bankrupt, or that it is simply ridden with mischief of people who padded their own pockets from its monies. Of course, that's true. It's true of any program that any government has ever devised. But it's equally true that the kind of program which was devised originally in terms of service from the rich to the poor, in terms of giving from our affluence to the poverty of the world, sharing food, building factories, establishing better forms of agriculture, that this kind of service, however it's managed and organized, is the only real service in the cause of peace, which we can, in fact, manage. In our world today, the rich nations, the powerful nations, are moving up the ladder of power and of progress at a rapid pace. And the overpopulated, impoverished nations are becoming more and more impoverished. And unless we find some way of closing this gap between the haves and the have-nots, between the rich and the poor, there's bound to be war. There's bound to be the kind of worldwide violence which no one can contain. If you have nothing in your belly and nothing in your soul, what have you to lose? And so I pray that the new administration, whichever administration it may be, will look to the stable, the last. We'll look to send teachers rather than tanks. We'll look to send seed rather than supersonic planes and factories rather than firepower. And I hope that none of us will demand of any administration in Washington complete solutions to any of the problems that face the world. They are simply not available. And those who promise quick solutions are almost always the military, who promise it with a few volunteers, a few tanks, and a few $1 million worth of military aid, a government we want to support, a political solution, a political problem we don't like seeing develop will somehow disappear. Well, that's precisely the way we got into Vietnam. It's precisely the way we got into Thailand. It's precisely the way we got originally into Korea. And it's precisely the way we will get into any number of further military dangerous entanglements unless we stop short now. And we recognize the limitations of American power, and the limited spheres, legitimate spheres of American power, the dangers of military solutions, the limitations of military solutions, the limitations of economic solutions, but their essential hopefulness. And there will be those who will not tell us to take the military road, but to take the isolationist road, whose quick solution will be to turn America in on herself. America feels itself very virtuous. We've tried to do good by the world, and the world has spurned us. You can't do it in a globe which can be girdled in less than an hour by a missile flying at supersonic speeds. You can't turn in on yourself. And there are those in Europe, in the Middle East, Asia, who depend upon our economic and our political interests and power for their security. There are no quick solutions. There are no complete solutions. And beware those who promise them to you. It's going to be a very costly world for us to live in. We've lived in a time when the frontier was still open, when America was spelled opportunity, when there was much for everyone and more than many needed. That period is coming to an end. Today, the need is for citizenship, for sharing, for spending for the common good, which is ultimately our individual good. Perhaps this is for the best. Certainly, this is as it has generally been. But when I look back in our tradition, and I look for the language and the vocabulary by which our tradition has described responsibility, life to us, I find very rarely the vaulting, graceful, happy, innocent images of the past 100 years, that life is to be enjoyed, that life is to be gulped down, that life is a dance, and all that you need is to take advantage of it. Rather, our tradition speaks of the Ol Malchut Shamayim, the Ol HaMitzvot, the yoke of the kingdom of God, the yoke of obligation. Man is a beast of burden. Man is yoked to the plow. And we remain burdened by our obligations until we grow old and some young person puts his neck and his shoulders to the work. Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, lo ata ben horin libatel mimena. You're not a free person. You're not, it's not up to you to complete the work. It'll never be done. And you can't desist from taking part in it. I don't paint, not painted, a very happy or gay picture. One honestly cannot be painted. Americans who would like to live the kind of abundant life, the life of the jet set, those who'd like to go flitting about from indulgence to indulgence are bound to be disappointed. Or if they insist on their special privileges, they will destroy the nation struggling for them. The America which we will know in the years ahead will be graceful in its opportunities for learning, for cultural experience, for family. For abundance, our abundance will have to be shared. And of privilege, if it be special privilege, there'll be very little. For unless we commit ourselves in the largest measure to the needs of the poor and the oppressed and the dispossessed, here and abroad, these people have now the firepower and the mobile power, the ability to move around, so that they will not take out their anger on their own, but on us. No longer can a society be satisfied to say to its poor, mañana, another day. They want their opportunity now. And that society will be stable only if it allows a sufficient number of these people, through their efforts and through ours, to move into the mainstream, to move into the field of opportunity which we all enjoy. Are there guaranteed solutions? I doubt it. Are there expensive therapies available, treatments? There are, and they must be taken. Taken with the sober realization that once we have spent the money, we will still have problems, though they may be of a different order, of a different nature. Taken because we are committed to justice. Taken because the larger wisdom is to solve the problems of today. The expectation that our children, in their wisdom, will solve the problems of their day.